The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
William Shatner, fondly remembered as Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise, will boldly go where Jeff Bezos has gone before, to the edge of space aboard Blue Origin's second flight with passengers. He's going to be the oldest ever passenger in the emerging space tourism industry.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That's pretty cool. I love William Shatner. I loved those early versions of Star Trek. I think they were filmed like in, the late 60s, 67 or something. I was a kid when I saw them, probably in the 70s. But they were reruns, right? They did really well in syndication and in rerun. But I think they only shot like 2 years of those things. And you look back and think, man, wouldn't it be great if they had done more of those? But of course, a lot of other reincarnations of the whole Star Trek franchise, that whole enterprise. But you know, William Shatner, who I'm sure a lot of astronauts today watched when they were kids, is 90 years old and made history. I just think that's so cool. I say bravo, William. Good job. Good job, Bill Shatner. Oldest person to go into space, you just heard. He joined three others on top of a Blue Origin rocket, and then he went into suborbital height. What's that mean? Well, it's about 66 miles above the Earth. That's pretty big. It's pretty far. You know what scares me about the whole thing? I mean, I'd love to go to space. And if anybody could get me there, boy, I'd be there in a heartbeat, right? It's a big dream of mine. I'm sure Bill Shatner probably wanted to go too at some point, and whoever thought that he'd have the opportunity at 90 to do that. But, you know, the scary part is being strapped upon a major explosive. I mean, accidents happen. Things blow up, right? Returning to Earth is just as frightening. So, of course, Shatner, as you know, played James T. Kirk. He was the captain of the Starship Enterprise. That series ran, as I said, in the late 60s, I think 66 to 69, somewhere in that ballpark, and then played him in the movie franchise later. But Blue Origin, if you're not familiar with that, they're owned by none other than Jeff Bezos and Amazon, and he's using now Blue Origin to run a space tourism operation. And things are prohibitive right now, unless you got a lot of money, you're probably not going to go to space. But I'll tell you one thing. Those costs will probably eventually come down. The rockets are all run remotely, so you really don't need a captain. You don't need, you know, anybody running the controls, so to speak, on board. There's actually, there's no captain required to actually pilot the rocket or the capsule. That's a little scary. But, you know, the whole thing lasted about 10 minutes from liftoff to touchdown there in the Texas desert. I would do it. I think that's super cool, and I'm fascinated by it, but I'm a geek, and I talk about this way too much. Anyway, this is the beginning. I mean, you're looking at the advent of a new era, if you ask me personally. I remember when I was in college, this begins to date me, as a journalism major at the time, I was punching my reports out on a typewriter. One of my roommates got a computer, and it transformed everything. Thank you. I just got a text here from Barry, who's listening. He says, Star Trek premiered in September of 1966. All right. You know, whoever thought the internet would take off and become what it is today? It has changed the world. It has made people millionaires and billionaires. You know, where would Jeff Bezos be today? Or Mark Zuckerberg, if it was not for the creation of the internet, right? Where would we all be? Even the way I'm able to broadcast in some capacity, my colleagues here, Patrick Madrid and others, the internet's such a big part of that. Patrick broadcasts remotely from Ohio, not out of one of our network studios, and he does it, you know, via the internet. So, what's the next big thing? I think it's space. I do. I think you're going to see a lot more people going to space. There's going to be a lot more satellites in the sky, as you know. We've seen this over Africa and play areas that don't have the internet. They're going to be used to, you know, give internet access to a lot of people. So the future's ahead. You're watching it. It's changing, and it's changing rapidly. Hey, in other news today, let's talk just about what's happening here at home, here on the ground. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she reaffirmed that she really wants the provision in that $3.5 trillion House reconciliation bill that allows the IRS to go looking into bank accounts when there's a transaction over $600 and when there's more than $600 of activity in a year. So if people are breaking the law, they're not paying their taxes, one way to track them down, she says, is through this banking measure. She said all this at a press conference just recently. In fact, she answered some reporters' questions on increased funding for the IRS. And the amount of money they want to fund the IRS is in the tune of billions. Billions, right? With all those extra agents, if you run a small business, if you make transactions larger than 600, give your kids 600 so they can get tires for the car or whatever, very well they can peek into your bank accounts. But she wants it as to be part of the reconciliation package. You know, infrastructure is one thing, but emboldening the IRS, I mean, because they have to pay for this somehow, right? You have to pay for it. So how do you do it? You hire a lot of agents to go and collect that cash for you. Take a listen to what she said. She was at a press conference. I think it was yesterday. And here's part of the exchange.
See, one of the pay-fors in the Build Back Better bill that's been proposed is IRS cracking down on some unpaid taxes. Mm-hmm. Banks are starting to get calls from customers, and they're reporting these calls. They're concerned about this tracking of transactions that has been $600. So Americans are starting to be worried about this. Do you think that this pay-for of giving the IRS more money to crack down on unpaid taxes is going to stay in the reconciliation?
Yes.
Or what do you say to Americans who are concerned about that?
Yes. Well, I mean, with all due respect, the plural of anecdote is not data. I've said that before here. Yes, there are concerns that some people have, but if people are breaking the law and not paying their taxes, one way to track them is through the banking measure. I think 600, but that's a negotiation that will go on as to what the amount is, but yes.
Yeah, and no kidding. Look, I'm not against cracking down on, like, you know, anybody who's conducting illegal activity. I think that's a good thing. This is much broader than that. You know, you're talking about a measure that would give $80 billion to the IRS. $80 billion to hire more employees and conduct more audits. I just see it as a collection agency. I think they're turning the IRS into a collection agency to pay for this $3.5 trillion. She also said she doubted that Americans have real concerns about the IRS looking into their bank accounts. You know, telling one reporter that, as you just heard there, the plural of antidote is not data. That's a non-answer, right? That goes along with something else she said about this bill. You know, and this really struck me. I was talking to one of my show team members earlier today. He says, you know, whether they're meeting Americas. I mean, she says, know it or not, Americans are overwhelmingly in support of it, whether they know it or not. You're going to love this, whether you know it or not. You're going to love what we have in here. It's like, hey, let's pass the bill so you can know what's in it and get away from all the fog. Remember when she was talking about Obamacare? That's the empty rhetoric that we're hearing. And again, this is not partisan. It's a slippery slope is what it is. It's really concerning. And I read a report earlier today, and I don't want to go too off tangent here, but there was a former citizen of China, this party left. And what she sees happening here in America right now with the Department of Justice, DOJ, and the school board meetings, these teachers, and what's happening with parents, she says that's right out of the Chinese playbook. And now when you see, you know, you expanding the government and its arm of collection by $80 billion to go rifle through your bank account because you decided to transfer $600 to your kid's account or, you know, give them some money for something that they might have needed or to your spouse or to whatever. I just think it's going to cause a lot of headaches, not only for individuals, but also for a lot of small businesses. Now, I'm hoping everybody is doing what's moral and right. I hope they do get people who aren't. But it's not as simple and as clean as she says. It's not just about, oh, we're going to peek in. This is going to give them a window into every American's finances. Just something for you to think about. Archbishop Timothy Broglio, he's the head of the military archdiocese. He's been on the program in the past. He just released a letter today, and he told priests of the archdiocese that, you know, military personnel, they're allowed to exercise their conscience if they don't believe that they should take the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, no one should be forced to receive the COVID-19 vaccine if it would violate the sanctity of his or her conscience, he said. So the question came up because the military is now requiring all service members to get vaccinated because the Holy See has said, look, it is morally permissible to get the vaccine because it would be, you know, because what is known as remote material cooperation. Maybe I should break that down and explain that in greater detail for you when it comes to moral theology. And this is what the church has taught. This is ultimately what the bishop is now standing on. And that whole remote moral material, the remote material cooperation, it means that the person that receives the vaccine had nothing to do with the original sin of the abortion. It's far enough removed that it's okay for you to get it. The statement from the Holy See has been taken by a lot of people in authority, from the president to the CEO of companies to military commanders and a lot of others, to mean that no Catholic can make an argument for religious exemption. But the Archbishop said, hey, that's not the case. And he quoted Pope St. Paul VI. And let me share with you what he said. He said, in all of his activity, a man is bound to follow his conscience in order that he may come to God, the end and purpose of life. It follows that he's not to be forced to act in a manner contrary to his conscience, nor, on the other hand, is he to be restrained from acting in accordance with his conscience, especially in religious matters. Now, I'll tell you what I'll do, because we don't have a whole lot of time today to do this. What I'll do tomorrow is I'm going to invite a couple guests on the program right around this time, and we are going to take a look at this issue. We'll talk about remote material cooperation. I'll explain what the church teaches regarding that. I'll even share, there was a great article I read about how, believe it or not, you probably already have vaccines that have been tainted with these abortive cells, you know, if you have the chickenpox vaccine or any of these others. So we'll take a look at that. We'll take a look at COVID, we'll go back and forth on that. I'm going to invite a biologist and some other people on the program. So we'll dive in that into that for you tomorrow. So do I have time for a call, Maggie, or I don't? All right, let me go ahead and grab a quick one here. We'll go to Bill, who's listening in Minnesota. Bill, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. I love your show, and you brought me closer to God. So amen, thank you for that. Hey, this is what I would like to present to you and for your thought. Sure. I don't believe that this is about taxation. Look at us. We're talking about taxation, regarding the legislation. What I truly believe it's about is looking at political contributions. They'll know both ends of the transaction. I'll give you this as my evidence.
That's a good point.
And that is, if you remember under the Obama administration, the IRS was weaponized under Lois Lerner. And they looked at all 501c3 organizations, and they targeted organizations that were conservative in nature. And that's very well documented. And I think that this is, they've got us thinking about taxes, not realizing that what they're really doing is a shell game, going after seeing what our political contributions are. Once that's identified, then the IRS will go there and be looking at, you know, making your life miserable, just like they did 8 or 9 years ago under the Obama administration. I truly believe that that's the angle.
Bill, that's such a great insight. You know, I never thought about how this can be used by a particular party politically. But I think that insight is right on. And I think you're right on a couple levels here. I mean, we saw how big tech has been able, I think, in some respects, to sway elections, to mute information, to present good versus bad information, depending on the candidate that it is. And why not dump $80 billion into the IRS, find out where political contributions go? I mean, if it's over $600, you got a window in. That gives you a lot of data, as Nancy Pelosi likes to refer to, go ahead and use it for whatever purpose they might. I love that. Great insight. Let me sneak another quick call in here before we wrap it up, before I got to change gears. I want to go to Christy in Glendale. Christy, good afternoon. I know you've been waiting as well. Good afternoon. Hi, Christy, you with me? All right, I'm going to put her back in queue. Sorry about that, Christy. I'm going to sneak you over here. I'll get to your call a little bit later. Let me change gears. I have a few moments here. And Bill, again, thank you for that insight. I'm going to continue to monitor that. I do want to talk about one other issue here. We're talking about exemptions, right? I want to get back to that. As you just heard a minute ago, the Archbishop of the Military Archdiocese He said to all the service members, and there are a number of military personnel, you may have a loved one, who doesn't want to get the vaccine for religious or moral reasons, right? They don't want to get the COVID-19 vaccine. And that's a right that New York State tried to take away from healthcare workers, right? So a couple months ago, I don't know if you've been following this or not, the state put a mandate into place on August 26th that would require all healthcare workers in the state, whether they're working, let's say, in the public or private sector, by September 27th, you need to get vaccinated. But the mandate, it explicitly denied them from the right to exercise conscience against receiving it. And when I saw that, I said, how can they do that? That's un-American. You can't do that. So 17 healthcare workers sued the state. They said to the state, they said, look, hold on. You are violating our First Amendment protections to freedom of religion. And in addition to that, you know, the state, of course, was allowing, you know, medical exemptions, but not religious ones. You can have a medical one, can't have a religious one. And that violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And according to Reuters, the plaintiffs who were suing, they used pseudonyms because, you know, they didn't want to be hounded by the media. They're so concerned about how the mob would come over them, come and reveal their personal medical data, right? So how this gets decided right now is being very closely watched because of the mandate that the Biden administration wants to put in place on private employers through through OSHA, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. And those rules haven't been developed yet, so the mandate isn't in place. But religious exemptions have been a sticking point for a lot of companies and federal employees. And this is coming. I'm telling you right now, this is coming. So I've invited today to join us, you know, Christopher Ferrari. He's a special counsel with the Thomas More Society, and he's been representing the 17th healthcare workers in the case. When I come back, I'll bring him into the conversation. I'll take your calls too. You can join us here at 888-914-9149 as we look at this and so much more. Stay with me.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Hey, thanks for your patience and welcome back. It's good to be with you today. A U.S. judge on Tuesday ruled that the state of New York can impose a COVID-19 vaccine mandate on healthcare workers without allowing religious exemptions, right? And the decision prevents the state from interfering with these religious exemptions. There seems to have been bias, some discrimination there a little bit earlier. And this ruling is actually, I think it provides a test case as vaccine opponents are now gearing up to fight plans to be unveiled by the Biden administration to extend these vaccine requirements to tens of millions of unvaccinated Americans. So a lot of people say, hey, I want my religious exemption. I am not taking anything tainted with an aborted fetal cell. I don't care whether it's tested in it or created in it. People have a right to say that. Other people have other reasons for maybe not getting it. So I've invited today for some perspective, Chris Ferrari, special counsel with the Thomas More Society. He's been representing those 17 healthcare workers in the case. You can find them online. This is a great organization. We do a lot of pro bono work, too, so I'm always a champion of supporting them. You can go to thomasmoresociety.org. And Christopher, thank you for your patience. I'm grateful for your insight today. Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me on the show, Drew.
So let's talk about New York. How did the state think they could say that religious exemptions weren't allowed, but medical exemptions were? What was the rationale behind that?
Discrimination. Bear in mind, we have a governor who has just come out publicly and said literally that this vaccine is inspired by God and that anyone who won't take one of these available vaccines is not doing what God wants, to quote her. But you know there's people out there who aren't listening to God and what God wants. You know who they are, end quote. She's also said that all major religious denominations have no problem with the vaccine. So basically this is a religious crusade by the governor of New York to force people to take a vaccine or one of the available COVID vaccines that they in conscience cannot partake in because it's connected in one way or another to abortion, either in testing, development, or production. So New York thought that it could get away with stripping out a religious exemption that was in the previous version of the vaccine mandate only 8 days earlier. It removed that exemption and allowed only a medical exemption. So the court held that that doesn't pass scrutiny under the First Amendment because once you set up an exception for medical reasons, you need to come up with a compelling reason and a narrowly tailored remedy for not allowing religious exemption. Bearing in mind that the religious objector and the person with the medical exemption work in the same hospital, treating the same patients at the same time. So there's no rational explanation for why one group would be given exemptions and the other would be denied exemptions, other than discrimination against religion.
Yeah. So do you think we're going to see more of this? And what's this case do? What kind of message does it send to other states as well?
It tells other states, and other states that generally follow this advice, that if you create exceptions to a governmental regulation for secular activities that are comparable to religious activities, you must grant an exemption to the comparable religious activities. You can't strip away the protection entitled to religious beliefs in the workplace under Title VII, or the protection entitled to religious beliefs under the First Amendment generally, and in particular the Free Exercise Clause. And the court in this case granted relief on both counts, the Title VII count and the count related to the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, because of the disparate treatment of religion versus the medical exemption.
Well, let me do this. Let me grab a call or two for you, too. If you're just joining us, we're taking a look at New York State allowing religious exemptions. There was a lot of discrimination prior to that, and this ruling is going to have, I think, a huge impact. Judith is listening in Appleton, Wisconsin, or Green Bay, somewhere in northeastern Wisconsin, and she's calling because she put in for a religious exemption. Judith, hi. If you can keep your comments kind of concise, that would be great. You're on with Christopher Ferrara.
Great. Hi, Counselor. I'm calling because I heard that, I have been denied my religious exemption at work and facing termination November 12th. And so me and my coworkers are kind of wondering, what do we do at this point?
Well, I'm not licensed in Wisconsin, but I can say generally what the approach should be to anyone facing discrimination in this particular case. You're entitled to a reasonable accommodation of your religious belief. If you have a conscientious objection to a vaccination by one of these vaccines, the employer has to engage in an interactive process with you to reach some kind of reasonable accommodation. The employer must grant you an accommodation unless the accommodation would be unduly burdensome, which at present means more than a minimal expense or difficulty for the employer. Now, if you're a healthcare worker and you've been in the front line, is that your situation? You're a nurse or a doctor?
I'm a nurse.
If you're a nurse and you've been in the front line caring for patients with the normal personal protection equipment, masks and perhaps goggles and gloves for the past 18 months, there's no possible way that an employer can reasonably maintain that all of a sudden those protections that were deemed adequate for frontline workers are suddenly not adequate, and so the employer would be unduly burdened. And there's also a factual issue that's developing in these cases. The CDC now admits that the vaccines do not prevent transmission of the Delta variant. CDC also admits that people who have been vaccinated can transmit the Delta variant to the unvaccinated, so that, as the president and the vice president have said, the vaccinated must be protected from the unvaccinated, because the vaccines apparently aren't that good at protecting you. And also, the unvaccinated must be protected from the vaccinated, per the CDC, because the vaccines don't prevent transmission. So that makes it even more unreasonable for an employer to say that the safety of patients and staff necessitates vaccination. It didn't for 18 months until the vaccines came available, and so it shouldn't be necessary for safety now. So what you do if your exemption is denied is you find an attorney who does Title VII employment discrimination work, and also in your state you may have a human rights statute that has parallel protections. You file a complaint for religious discrimination. If you have a grievance procedure at your hospital, you should be following that. And I would not accept that decision. I would contest it and proceed along the channels of a religious discrimination claim. And then ultimately, in most states, you'd get a right to sue letter if the agency doesn't want to sue on your behalf, and then you just bring a suit. I would not take it lying down.
All right. Judith, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. She's not alone. I just want to follow up on that without getting too legal. I know employers are going to be facing this. A lot of small businesses and other employers are looking, to their employees' pasts now, checking to see if they really have a religious, you know, viewpoint on vaccines or, you know, or not before they approve the exemption claims. They can't do that, can they? If somebody today says, hey, I have a religious exemption, they've got to honor that, right? Or the employers are also looking to see if they've received other vaccines in the past. And are employers allowed to do that? What's the limit an employer has to mandate or dictate whether somebody's religious claim is valid and to go in their past and to see whether or not they've been vaccinated and make their determination based on that?
In the employment context under Title VII, the Supreme Court, in its First Amendment jurisprudence and the EEOC in its guidance has made it clear that what controls here is your religious belief. If you have a sincerely held religious belief that counsels you not to partake in these vaccines, that's what the employer has to accommodate. It doesn't matter what the Pope says. It doesn't matter what some bishops think. It doesn't matter what other bishops think. In fact, the EEOC guidance says that the fact that your belief may not even be supported by your nominal religion is not determinative of whether you have a sincere religious belief. As far as previous vaccines, maybe people didn't know that these vaccines were abortion-connected. But even if they knew, there's no reason that they can't take a different position with respect to these vaccines. Now that the issue has come to the fore. And, you know, there's a broader reason for refusing the vaccines, which goes beyond whether they're abortion-connected. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, in its December 2020 statement, which was approved by Pope Francis, declares that vaccination is not, as a rule, morally obligatory and must be voluntary, any kind of vaccination. So one can have a religious conviction, independently of whether a vaccine is connected to abortion, that the state has no right to inject you with a medicine that you don't want and don't believe that you need, right, and which, according to your risk-benefit assessment, might be more harmful than good. That in itself rises to the level of religious conviction. It's you versus the state, and you standing up to the state as a matter of conscience informed by your religion and saying, no, you will not force me to be vaccinated with this substance. It doesn't matter what substance it is.
Well, we'll see where this all leads. I'm grateful for what you do with the Thomas More Society. I know you do a lot of pro bono work there, and you've represented these 17 plaintiffs in this case. This is not going away. You know, when the president starts to have, businesses police, mandate, vaccines, we're going to see a lot more cases, I would think. What do you see? Just kind of final thoughts here coming in the not too distant future when it comes to COVID-19 and employers and mandates and all the rest, schools, et cetera.
Well, I think that this is a process that's spiraling out of control, and judicial intervention is the only way to stop it. I have never seen anything like this in all the years I practice law. It's an absolute fanatical mania to force people to be injected with these vaccines, in spite of the evidence, as they themselves admit, the CDC, for example, aren't really all that effective in preventing transmission or infection. You know that in Israel, for example, 90% of the population has been vaccinated, and all of the breakthrough infections now, including deaths and hospitalizations, are among the vaccinated. We have the president taking his third shot. What's next? Right. The fourth shot, the fifth shot, the sixth shot? Mm-hmm. Will someone's employment be on the line every time they come up with a new vaccine? Are you going to become a pincushion at the command of a health bureaucracy? This is ridiculous. So sooner or later, judicial intervention, I think, has to lay down some principles here. And the most basic principle is people have religious objections to these vaccines. There's no reason on earth that those objections can't be accommodated. And so I think it's going to come to a head probably in the circuit courts and ultimately in the United States Supreme Court. And we have to establish clear principles going forward, because obviously, if you're going to be objective about this, these campaigns for vaccination are now moving beyond any real concern about public health, and they're becoming political struggles.
Yeah, it's a great point. Hey, Christopher, thank you. Thanks for your time. I got to leave it right there. I'm grateful for it. Check him out. He's special counsel for the Thomas More Society, and their organization, thomasmoresociety.org, as I said, great organization. And I'll tell you what, tomorrow we'll look at this from both sides. I do think religious exemptions are such a big part of this. I'm sitting here as he's talking, I'm thinking about the arc of our conversation, the trajectory of this story from back in late 2019, 2020, as the world was filled with fear and anxiety over this virus, the lives it was taking, the media, you know, really they're showing you body bags and hospitals and people in multiple layers of PPP. And I mean, it was a terrifying time for a lot of people. The economic implications of this, the advent of a new vaccination, right? You had the Pfizer, the Moderna, then the J&J, and you know, there's talk of others in the pipeline. Now we're hearing reports of breakthroughs. You know, you have the Delta right now, and the latest Mu, and some of these others that are breakthroughs that are affecting populations like Israel that have 90% vaccination rates. And you know, I just read a report this morning that the Pfizer vaccine, which I think a lot of people have gotten, the efficacy of that's down about 55% right now. So, but then what's the next part of the story? And it's ever evolving. That's why every week I try to at least give you a perspective on it and always try to take a moral look, you know, at the challenges that face us, whether it's our religious exemptions or, you know, how the vaccine is made or what the church is saying about it. The next big thing right now that we're seeing are these mandates, and we're seeing people lose their jobs. And we saw what happened with Southwest Air and a lot of other places. I think there's going to be certain labor shortages in very critical areas of industry if people say, hey, enough is enough. But as I said, tomorrow at this time, we'll revisit this. We'll take another look, slightly different perspective, and you are always welcome to join us. So feel free anytime. Anytime to join me, okay? A number here to get in, 888-914-9149. I do want to talk about something else. You know, I'm a cultural observer. One of the things I like to do here, as with COVID, is watch the trend, the track, the arcs. Look at what's coming, what's down the road, what may even lie around the bend. And anger in this country, I want to talk about that for a moment. These mandates cause it, these school board meetings, you see a lot of anger there. I don't think there's a secret that the mood in our country right now is hot. The mood of our country right now is angry. Whether it was the death of George Floyd, you know, the burning of buildings, the looting of buildings, restaurants being forced to close when other ones can be open. I mean, you see people getting angry. They're angry at the government. Yeah, they're angry at the church. They're angry. They're just angry. They're just angry. And this is not new. It's been this way for quite a number of years. I mean, there was a scholar, he says that since 1950, in that decade, that Americans have raised anger to the level of performance art. I was struck by that. It made me think. He says, if you look at the last, let's say, 70 years, right? Go back 70 years. You can really see where he's right in a lot of areas of our cultural life, right? Take a look at race. Take a look, you know, in the late 60s, you know, the anti-riots of the war in the 60s into the 70s, the constant demonstrations that took place during the 1980s, and all of those demonstrations have continued up and through our day. Now there's a rise. There's a rise of, you know, heavy metal and rap music. There's a lot of anger sometimes coming through music, through cinema, people shooting in schools, workplaces. You get the gist of what's going on, right? It can be argued that the temperature here in America, the anger level, has escalated. And so others might say, well, come on, Drew. There's always been anger in American politics at one level or another. You know, starting from the very beginning. Look at Jefferson, right? Thomas Jefferson wasn't an entirely welcome president. There have been demonstrations against one thing or another, the labor riots of the early 20th century, for instance, the Know-Nothing riots against Catholics. There's the outbreak of the Civil War, which was, you know, anger, you know, writ large. I mean, so there's something different about the anger that we're experiencing today, I would argue, right? Dr. Peter Wood believes that too. He's actually the president of the National Association of Scholars and a former anthropology professor. And he's the author of 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. One of his latest books is called Wrath, America in Rage. Just came out. You can check it out at Encounter Books. And I've invited him to stop by today because I think this conversation is worth having. If the temperature, if the anger level of this great nation of ours is rising, how do we diffuse it? How do we cool things down? How do we bring peace and civility back to a culture that has turned anger into an art, if you will? Hey, Doctor, good afternoon. It's good to have you with me.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I'm delighted. So let's talk about the differences you are observing. What's so different, let's say, about the anger you saw rising from the 1950s until now versus, I don't know, all the anger that's been in the country from the beginning. We've had civil wars, right? We've had a great divide in the early years of the American Republic as well. What are you seeing that's different?
I think the main thing that's happened here is that we've gone from being a culture that counseled people to control their anger. Of course, anger is part of human nature. People are always getting angry. The question has always been, what do you do with it? Do you try to put it aside? Do you try to overcome it? Do you try to deal with the person or the situation that's provoked you? Or do you give into it and let fly? Up in the 1950s, the choice of, okay, I'm going to go into it and be as angry as I want to be, was viewed as a weakness, and people were shamed for doing that sort of thing. Brawlers were not our national heroes. The person who was cool under fire was the one who was heroic. The situation began to change in, you know, fairly marginal ways at first, and we got our first taste of Freudian psychoanalysis, which told people that bottling up your anger will come back to you as neurosis. So not a good thing to do, express it. And we had other people who were enamored with the French existentialists teaching us that to be really authentic, to be true to yourself, means getting in touch with that angry part. And that got taken up by the protest movements of the 50s, which were just getting underway. This sort of expressionist anger, willingness to perform it in public, didn't just sweep across the country all at once, and we went from being people who were reticent and self-controlling to people who were out of control and flamboyant. It took a couple of generations, and there's a good reason for that, which is we learn our emotional control in childhood for the most part, and when we're brought up in a family that says, cut your tantrum or you are going to go to your room, you get a different kind of child from the one who throws a tantrum and gets what he wants. Well, a couple generations of more and more progressive child-rearing techniques have brought us to the point where anger is now completely established as a norm. We don't think twice about the stuff that's going on. If people are chanting obscene slogans at football games, it's a kick. I mean, we all just laugh at it now. Stuff that would have been unthinkable not so long ago is not only thinkable, but is day in and day out practice. Now, that's not to talk about the political realm at all, so let me put it into the politics. Anger as a form of public protest has been sort of written into the DNA of the American left for a long time, well before the 1950s, protest and taking a strong line against the capitalist pigs was part of what the left just did. But when it got combined with what I call this new anger, this expressive anger of the 1950s and onward, it took a much more virulent form to the point where it became a kind of lifestyle. People get up in the morning, they want to be angry, and if they're not angry, they look for reasons to get there. Indignation becomes a way of life. And I would say that kind of anger has grown up now to its full potential. It's an adult tree at this point, the anger tree in which people get their sense of wholeness and life fulfillment out of anger is something that is characteristic of the American left. Well, anger didn't forget the American right. There are lots of people on the right who've been angry too. Their kind of anger is a bit different. For one thing, it's conflicted. Conservatives are sufficiently tied to tradition that they know that there's not something totally right about cutting loose and just spouting off. The closest we've come to a fully realized version of new anger on the right was probably the emergence of talk radio in the 1980s. And I think Donald Trump is kind of a creature of that world. He became a showman of anger on TV. You know, there's one famous episode with the World Wrestling Federation where a mocked-up version of Donald Trump went after a mocked-up version of Rosie O'Donnell. I can't think of a better exemplification of performative anger, but it's also got this quality of humor about it. It's not just a straight-out, I hate you and I'm going to destroy you. It's I'm going to mock you and make fun of you. So that's the anger of the right, or at least it was the anger of the right until just the other day, by which I mean the 2020 election, which a good many Americans, including me, believe was a product of manipulation and mischief, if not outright fraud, followed by the riot on January 6th, which got played up as an insurrection, have left conservatives, by and large, feeling like their avenues of public expression have been shut off.
Hey, Doctor, hold the thought for me if you could. I got to take a short pause here. When we come back, we'll pick it up. I'll take a few of your calls. I have a couple moments with my guest today, Dr. Peter Wood. We're taking a look at the rise of anger in America.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Wow, what a great rejoin, Maggie. That's so too. It's so true, right? We're talking, if you're just joining us, about the rise in anger. And I am speaking today with the author of a brand new book called Wrath, America Enraged, just out from Encounter Books. And it's good to have with me Dr. Peter Wood. And we're just taking a look at, there's always been anger in American history, in American politics especially. But today, there's no question that we seem to be experiencing an unprecedented demonstration of it. And to me, the big question is, well, how do you short-circuit that? How do we bring peace and civility back to a culture that seems to have abandoned that? And Doctor, I am grateful for your writing and for your time. I think the media, personally, I mean, you talked about politics and Donald Trump and a whole lot of other things that really got people angry. How much does the media contribute to this anger? And I'm thinking not just about how, let's say, performers or personalities do, but the very presence of especially electronic and mass media, radio. You talk about talk radio, you talk about television, now the internet. You know, we have these social media platforms that help to spread and feed, if you will, this rage. So how much does the media contribute to this? And you know, has that really helped to exacerbate the rise that we're seeing today? Because if you go back to the 50s or some of the earlier decades we were referring to, it wasn't at the same level of intensity as it is today.
Well, I think you're exactly right about this. One thing what modern media gives us is an almost instantaneous reward. That is, if you want your opinion out there, it's out in fractions of a second on Twitter or perhaps a few minutes on Facebook. The use of social media to find an echo chamber for your opinions or to troll other people and get provoked reactions from them makes the performative anger a sport in which anybody can engage. You don't need to have access to MSNBC or CNN or Fox News in order to get into the game now. So that changes things considerably. The world of the mass media has been to amplify the angry messages that come from politicians. It becomes a place where the American public learns to find new sources of resentment on an almost daily basis. And I, for my job, I have to pay attention to what's going on in the news. So from the moment I get up in the morning, I'm dealing with issues that provoke me. And I know that's not an unusual situation, that Americans now live in this world where the media realize it's to their advantage to keep people on edge and ready to
So what do we do, Doctor? We only have about a moment or a couple of moments here left. As individuals and just really as a nation, what can we do to lower the temperature? And I really think there's been a tremendous abandonment of civility in our culture today. There's no tolerance. There's a great spirit of intolerance, even though you hear this call to be tolerant and accept everybody and their behavior and what they identify and think at. There's very little tolerance for one another and others' thoughts. How do we bring the temperature down? How do we bring unity and civility back to the country?
Well, the best way to get unity and civility is to model it in your own life. If you can be faced with provocation and not give it sway over you, you'll probably impress others a lot more than you would if you start raging with four-letter words. Mm-hmm. So there's that. I do think that we're still a Christian nation in large part. People need to be reminded that anger is a sin and that there is a need to lead a good life that requires learning to combat this. So turning to God helps, but we're also a secular society, and which that's not a recipe that will work for everybody. Right. What else we need to do is begin to find places where these outbursts of anger are not rewarded with attention and ratings, but instead are punished by people just turning their attention elsewhere. Hard to do, but that's what we need to do.
That's a great point. My grandmother had an old adage. She used to say, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. Let me sneak a quick call in before we run out of time. Christina's been waiting to join the conversation. She's in Chicago. Hi, Christina.
Hi. So I came across a quote yesterday because I am angry, and I'm trying to figure out how to deal with my anger over the mandate, over abortion. And this quote spoke to me a little bit from Thomas Aquinas. It says, he who is not angry when there is just cause for anger is immoral. Why? Because anger looks to the good of justice. And if you can live amidst injustice without anger, you are immoral as well as unjust. And I feel like maybe we do need to get a little angry, and our anger needs to be, you know, backed with some action. We need to stand up for what is unjust and what is wrong.
Yeah, it's such an excellent contribution to the conversation, Christina. Just anger. She quotes, of course, the great St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the great doctors of the Catholic Church. Brilliant intellect. Doctor, your thought on that. Let's talk just anger. There is a time, there is a place for anger.
Of course there is, and Aquinas was basically building on Aristotle on that point. Anger is an emotion that we need in order to have a just community, but it's something that has to be dealt with as being angry at the right times and for the right reasons, and knowing what the right times and right reasons are requires spiritual discernment, not given to everybody. So there is an element there that we need to work on. I certainly think that not only is anger sometimes justified, but that especially intense form of anger that I call wrath is sometimes justified as well. It's justified when we're faced with situations that do not admit to quiet reason or persuasion in other forms. It's a short answer, but that's the best.
It's perfect, Doctor. Thank you. I got to leave it there because I'm out of time, but I want to make sure everybody gets plugged into your latest work. And his book is published by Encounter Books, and you can do a search for Wrath, America Enraged. The name of the author, again, Dr. Peter Wood. He's the president of the National Association of Scholars and a former anthropology professor. Doctor, thank you. Keep up your good work. Hope to talk to you again soon. You know, let me leave you with this thought. You know, anger, of course, is one of those seven deadly sins. And the fact that we are immersed in it means that we have some repentance to do. So if you find yourself prone to that, as a Catholic, I say get to confession. Examine your conscience and do what the doctor said. Do your part to make a difference.